arrived, but it occurred to me I should hang on to my room so I could put a call through to Henry prior to my departure. I had just enough time now to pack my belongings and get myself centered before the meeting. I could also use the opportunity to make a few quick notes. A woman called out, "Kinsey?" I knew the minute I turned around I was looking at Ethan's wife. Mamie wasn't fat by any means, but she was solid. She was taller than I and a good 40 pounds heavier. Dark eyes, dark hair skinned back and held with a clip at the nape of her neck. Her face was full, tanned, as though she spent all of her waking hours outdoors. She was packed into a pair of black slacks and a crisp white blouse, the shirt tail out and belted at the waist. She wore big silver hoop earrings, and she carried the manila envelope I had left behind with Ethan. I knew it was the same because in one corner I could still see the imprint of Binky's wee front teeth. Behind Mamie, seated on the couch, was Evelyn Dace, whose expression I can only describe as sorrowful. She wore a lightweight tweed suit, wren brown, with a white polyester blouse under the jacket, topped by a big, softly draped bow. Mamie was holding her hand out. "Mamie Iserman." Her voice was of the booming type. I shook hands with her obligingly, murmuring exactly what one does in situations of the kind. "Let me introduce you to Evelyn," she said. "I hope you don't mind our coming early." "Not at all," I said, though I did mind. The move was meant to catch me off guard, which it had. In the meantime, I couldn't help but think that Ethan and Mamie were as unlikely a married couple as any I'd seen. She carried herself with authority. He seemed both self-involved and clueless about others' perception of him. I was impressed by his stage persona, but not with the man himself. I wondered if Mamie had any idea how he behaved when he was out of her sight. Surely any woman married to a musician has some inkling of what goes on. I tagged Evelyn Dace at roughly her ex-husband's age, which I knew was 53 at the time of his death. Her eyes were blue, but not the same bright shade as Anna's. The orbs of her eyes seemed sunken, defined by shadow. She kept her smile modest, as though the hardships in life had robbed her of humor and hope. We shook hands. Anna had told me Mamie and Evelyn didn't get along, so the two must have set aside their hostilities in order to present a united front. I might have felt flattered, but I realized a better interpretation was that the two had now merged their antagonisms, the better to focus them on me. Mamie said, "I talked to the manager, and he says we can use the conference room as long as we're out by noon." I thought, 2 hours? Shit! "No problem. I'm on my way home, so I don't have long. I'd like to be on the road by 11. "So you said on the phone. I hope you're not thinking to cut the discussion short. What if we haven't reached an agreement?" "About what?" "Well, I can see you're already being argumentative." "Let's just see how it goes," I said, not wanting to engage. We might end up in a fight, but it didn't have to start right now. She led the way down a short side corridor off the lobby, in a section of the hotel set aside for trade shows and conventions of a modest sort. The room we entered could have accommodated 50 people, but not many more. Windows ran the length of the room. The carpet was dark blue, and the walls were faced with a neutral fabric meant to deaden sound. I could imagine a meeting in progress, coffee carafes arranged on the sideboard with trays of sweet rolls, donuts, and other pastries. Maybe a fruit platter if management wanted to make a show of healthy choices. The big conference table would be furnished with a scratch pad and ballpoint pen at each place. There'd be pitchers of ice water with plastic cups stacked nearby. I truly wished I were going to that meeting instead of the one pending. This table was bare, and the room was empty, except for a white board with an instant erase marker pen. Someone had drawn a Kilroy Was Here cartoon in the center. We arranged ourselves at one end of the conference table, Mamie at the head. I took the seat to her right, so I was facing the door. Evelyn sat across from me. With the glare from the window at my back, she probably couldn't see my facial features. I glanced at Mamie. Where do you want to start? She removed a copy of the will from the manila envelope, leafing through the pages like a prosecuting attorney approaching the witness stand. Some of the faux friendliness had faded, and we were getting down to brass tacks. I have to say we're perplexed. Evelyn and I were talking on the way over, and she reminded me that before Terence went to prison, he drew up a will that was nothing like this one. She fixed her brown eyes on mine. He rewrote his will after he arrived in Santa Teresa. The date's probably on there someplace. This was after he and Ethan quarreled, and he left Bakersfield. Must have been a hell of a fight if this was the end result. Ethan said you were there. You want to talk about what went on? The less said about that, the better, Mamie remarked, her expression chaste. Terence was drunk, Evelyn said. No big surprise. He was always drunk. Oh, sorry. I didn't realize you were there, or I'd have asked your impression. I'm telling you what I heard. I turned my attention to Mamie. Anna says Ethan spit in his father's face. Is that true? That was uncalled for. I told Ethan he was way out of line on that score. Even so, I don't believe it warranted this level of retaliation. Evelyn jumped in. I'm in total agreement with Mamie. We can't understand why you've been given a role in such an intimate family affair. How in the world did you end up executor of the estate? My husband's death is distressing enough without this blow on top of it. Ex-husband, Mamie said. I was as surprised as anybody else, I replied. I'll just bet you were, Evelyn said, cutting me short. Mamie gave Evelyn a warning look. Well, I don't see why we should shilly-shally around, Evelyn said, bristling. And I don't see why I should sit by while you turn this into a big, stinking fight, Mamie snapped back. If you like, I can go through the chain of events, I said. Mamie's gaze flicked to mine. Please. First of all, you know who Rebecca Dace was? Evelyn spoke up. She was Terence's aunt. Her brother Randall was Terence's father. She had another brother named Sterling, but he died some years ago. Rebecca Dace married my grandfather, Quillen Milhone. He and Rebecca had one child, my father, Randall Terence Milhone. From what I've been able to piece together, he was Terence's favorite uncle. Which doesn't answer my question, Evelyn said. Why did you inherit all that money with such a flimsy blood tie? You're barely related to us at all. It just doesn't seem right. I'll tell you as much as I know, I said, and repeated my account, which I rendered in excruciating detail, hoping to dispense with any questions she might pose. When I finished, both women stared at me. Mamie shook her head slightly, checking the last page of the will to make sure she hadn't missed anything. What about these witnesses? We don't recognize the names. Those were friends of his, Evelyn said. Well, I'm happy he had friends. That wasn't always the case. I'm sure you understand why we'd be skeptical. You want to tell me what's on your mind? Evelyn reached for the will and checked the pages as Mamie had. Well, who is this Mr. Singer? Have you any idea? He and Terence met at a homeless shelter. I didn't make the man's acquaintance until last week. What about Ms. White and Mr. Bider? I met them at the same time, I said. Dan Singer told me the three of them witnessed the will at Terence's request. It was all straightforward and above board. They're homeless? Mamie asked. Her tone put them in the same low company as pedophiles. Yes. She blinked. Do they have mental health issues? Not that I observed. What about problems with substance abuse? I thought, oops. I've only known them a week, I said, as though that ruled out my opinion. Evelyn's turn. But you see why we'd question the signatures if these three misfits were drunk or mentally impaired. Actually, I think only two witnesses are required, so I'm willing to concede one of them. Mamie stared at me. Is that a joke? Sorry, I didn't mean to be flip. If you want to challenge their competence, you'll have to hire an attorney and take them into court. There's no point in our discussing the issue since none of us are qualified mental health professionals, as far as I know, I added, having eliminated our law degrees in the earlier conversation. A little knot appeared between Mamie's brows, but her tone remained mild. All this talk about attorneys, is that really what you want? All I want is to avoid turning this into a personal debate, Evelyn said. But why bring attorneys into it? We'll end up paying them the lion's share, and how will any of us benefit? This is not something we can settle among the three of us. This is awkward. It's not a matter of awkwardness. It's a question of what's right. Terence was angry, Evelyn said. Okay, fine. That's true as far as it goes. Sounding slightly more conciliatory, she went on. I'm not blaming him. I'm only pointing out that if he'd had a chance to calm down, he might have reversed himself. But he didn't. In point of fact, what we're left with is what's spelled out in that document, I said. Here's what you don't seem to grasp, Mamie said. Terence loved his children. You've been drawn into a drama that goes back many years. I don't think you appreciate the hardships they endured. I don't know how Evelyn managed to hold her head up. Mamie glanced at Evelyn as she said this, and Evelyn managed to look especially stricken. Look, I can understand how difficult it must have been. That doesn't change anything, Evelyn said. You know, he offered them the money. Are you aware of that? I'm assuming that's why he came to Bakersfield, I said. That's exactly right. The minute he had the settlement in hand, he called Ethan saying he wanted to make amends. He talked about dividing the money equally among the three children to compensate them for their suffering. You keep referring to them as children when they're fully grown adults, I said. She dropped her gaze. I suppose I'll always think of them as children. Do you have any of your own? I don't. Then it might be hard for you to fathom how a mother feels. Off topic, Mamie warned. Evelyn gave her a hard look and turned back to me. What I'm getting at is I may not know how the law works, but in my mind, and Terence's as well, his talking to them about splitting the money was the same as a verbal contract, Mamie said. Evelyn, I'm not sure you're helping matters. I'm guessing Kinsey's already spoken to an attorney since she's brought it up so many times. I'm just telling her how I see the problem. Terence wanted to do right by them, which is why he came back. Mamie flicked a look at me. She might have a point. Thank you, Evelyn said tartly, and then turned to me. Surely you don't believe the terms are fair, after what they went through. Terence felt rejected, and he rejected them in response, but it's not unreasonable to imagine him regretting his haste. It's unfortunate he died before he had a chance to undo the harm. Doesn't that seem reasonable to you? I indicated the papers. The will is dated July 8, 1988. He and Ethan quarreled in September, 10 months before. That's hardly acting in haste. He had time to think about what he was doing, both before and afterward. Evelyn went on as though I hadn't said a word. You have no idea how much that money would mean to them. This could be a life-changing event, she said. There was a small tremor in her voice that I thought was entirely manufactured. I'm not here to negotiate. I made that clear to Mamie on the phone. Hear me out, as a courtesy, if nothing else. She kept her eyes on me as though waiting for my permission to continue. I gestured her on. As executor of the estate, you're in a position to tip the balance, don't you think? No. Then how do you see your role? It's not a role, As executor, it's my job. Your job, then. I'm responsible for seeing that his assets are distributed according to the provisions in the will. I can't just make these things up. I have to answer to the court. But once this is settled, you do have a say in what happens from that point on. If the judge decides the will's in order, I'll see that Terence's wishes are carried out. That's the only power I have. But isn't this a conflict of interest? You admit you had no relationship with Terence, and yet you've managed to insert yourself between the man and his own offspring. Why can't you give them a chance to accomplish something in life? Let's not go on with this. Please believe me when I tell you it's not up to me. That's not true, Evelyn said. All that money's going to end up in your pocket, isn't it? In theory, I suppose. What I'm suggesting is that once the money's yours, you can do anything you want with it. Isn't that correct? I raised a hand. I want to talk about something else. Evelyn said, I haven't finished making my point. I'm not saying you shouldn't have a share, but think about this. If you divided it four ways, you'd each come out with about $150,000 apiece, which seems equitable. I was shaking my head, irritated that she was pressing the point. Mamie interceded. Would you let Kinsey have a turn? You've talked long enough. She turned to me. What were you going to say? I loved how cranky she was. I said, I'd like to back up a bit if you don't mind. Here's what I don't get. All this posturing aside, why weren't Ethan and Anna more charitable when Terence was exonerated? I know Ellen was out of town when he arrived, but Ethan and Anna both still believe he killed Karen Coffey, even with all the evidence that came to light. Why weren't they happy? Why didn't they rejoice? That's the crux of the problem, isn't it? Not that they believed he was guilty, but that they refused to believe he was innocent. You'd have to ask them. I wouldn't presume to speak for them. After all, they're adults, as you so aptly pointed out. I said, can we stick to the point? Terence cut them out of the will because they mistreated him, yes? I grant you their behavior was unfortunate, but let's not make matters worse, she said. That's not where I'm going with this. Do you know why they quarreled? Because Terence was drunk, she said. No. They quarreled because you insinuated he'd actually had a hand in that girl's death. Mamie waved that aside. That's ridiculous. Evelyn did no such thing. Yes, she did. I looked at Evelyn. If you hadn't poisoned the well, your children might have been receptive to their father's overtures. They might have accepted the fact that he was cleared of wrongdoing. If the visit had been a good one, he'd have left them everything, so this is really more about you than it is about me. Evelyn lowered her gaze. Color was creeping up her neck, which I considered a thrilling sight. She said, I don't think you understand the relationship they had. They worshipped him. He was a hero to them. When this hideous crime came to light, they were devastated. I wanted them to realize that he wasn't quite the innocent victim he portrayed himself. You think he killed her? I think he had the means, the motive, and the opportunity. What are you talking about? This isn't a television drama. Karen was Ethan's friend. She'd been to the house more than once. So what? I could see Terence took a shine to her. I never had any proof, but I wasn't at all shocked when the police came to the door and asked to speak to him. He looked terrible. His skin was gray. He was sweating and his hand shook. That's not the demeanor of an innocent man. Mamie looked at her mother-in-law with disbelief. Are you serious? He shook and turned gray any time a drink was overdue. Evelyn was still focused on me. I don't know where in the world you got the idea I turned the children against him. I'd never do such a thing, she said. I heard it from Anna. She told me last night. Told you what? Mamie asked, annoyed at being out of the loop.
Nothing, Evelyn said.
This was beginning to feel like politics, consisting as it did almost entirely of finger-pointing and accusations. I turned to Mamie. Anna told me the day her father called to say he'd been released. Evelyn confessed that she lied on the witness stand. She said he went out that night and was gone until the wee hours. Mamie looked at Evelyn with dismay.
You did that?
I said, oh, yes, indeed. She also told the three of them not to mention it to anyone for fear she'd be charged with perjury, which is a criminal act.
Ask Ethan. He'll tell you the same thing. Ellen, too.
Mamie was staring at her mother-in-law.
I don't believe it. You said he was there at the house when he wasn't?
I wagged a finger, correcting her. It was the other way around. She told the truth on the witness stand and lied about it later.
But why would she do that? She'd have to be nuts.
Evelyn leaned toward me.
You don't know what you're talking about. Were you there? Of course I wasn't.
But I'll tell you who was. An hour ago, I talked to Lolly Brandle. Mamie wrinkled her nose in confusion.
Who?
The woman who lived next door to Evelyn and Terrence back then. She was at the Dace's house the night Karen Coffey disappeared. She says Terrence was home the entire evening except for a brief trip to the store to pick up ice cream. Evelyn's tone was prim.
You can hardly credit her account. She has dementia.
She may not remember what happened yesterday, but she remembers that night, right down to the flavor of the ice cream he went out to buy. Here's a question for you, Evelyn. Who was the President of the United States at that time?
I have no idea. How is that relevant?
Because Lolly knows. I asked her the same thing, and her memory is as clear as a bell. Richard Nixon.
I can see you're determined to take her word over mine, she said. I've been to visit her twice. She has no idea who I am, and I've known her 25 years. Besides which, how do you know she isn't lying for reasons of her own?
Because the pastor of your church was also there with his wife. I'd be happy to track them down, and I'll bet you they'll back Lolly Brandle. Are you going to call them liars as well?
I did not commit a crime.
I know you didn't. You told Ethan and Ellen and Anna you lied on the stand when you actually told the truth in court. Later, you insinuated that Terrence went out that night and had a hand in that girl's death. You didn't accuse him outright. You undercut his credibility, and you did such a fine job of it that Ethan and Anna were completely alienated from their dad, and still are, for that matter.
Accuse me of anything you like. You have no proof, and there's nothing you can do about it, even if you did.
You got me on that one. At least Mamie knows now. And we'll see what she does with it. Chapter 22. The meeting faltered to a close, and we parted company. Verbal clashes seldom come to a satisfying end. They peter out in weak retorts that leave you wishing you'd been as clever in the moment as you are in reviewing the conversation later. I hadn't scored even one decisive point, and none of us had altered our positions in the slightest. I was glad I'd met Evelyn, because I had a better sense now of who she was and how she operated. Poor Dace. I had formed a ragged picture of his life, joining fragments like a reel of film spliced together with all the big scenes missing. The storyline was there, but the point was lost. The meaning of life, assuming there is one, is the glue we use to join events, trying to fill the cracks in hopes the whole of it will make sense. Beginning, middle, and end don't always add up to much. And, in his case, only an odd note of melancholia remained. I went up to my room and packed. I took the elevator down and presented myself at the front desk with my duffel in hand. I signed the credit card receipt and returned my key. It wasn't until I was crossing the parking lot that I saw Ethan Dace appear on the far side of the Mustang. He'd parked his banged-up white Toyota in the slot to the left of mine. At first I thought he'd crouched between the two cars to keep himself out of view, but maybe he'd only bent to tie his shoelace. I was on the verge of asking how he'd figured out where I was, but we all knew by then that my grabber blue Mustang was better than a flashing neon sign. Casually, he turned and opened his passenger side door. He tossed something onto the front seat before he slammed the door again and turned to face me. He tilted his head in the direction of the hotel entrance. What was that about? What was what about? I saw my wife and mom leave just now. You call a meeting? That was Mamie's idea. She had questions about the will. It was a waste of time, in my opinion, but I wanted to show what a good sport I am. What else did you talk about? That was it, I said. Then the light dawned. Oh, now I'm getting it. You think I summoned Mamie and your mom so I could tattle on you? Nothing to tattle. I was talking to a friend. My mistake. It looked like you were flirting with that red-headed hottie. Anna's friend, isn't she? I didn't catch her name. That's none of your business. Fear not, good sir. My lips are sealed. Now, if you'll step away from my car door, I'd like to get in. For some reason, that set him off. He rose up on the balls of his feet, leaning toward me while he jabbed a finger in my face. The fact that he didn't raise his voice made the underlying anger more sinister than the threat that followed. You want to make trouble? I'll make trouble for you, and don't think I won't. What did you have in mind? I'll sue. Me and my sisters will sue your ass. You get that? I do. Thanks so much. Is there anything else? You better lawyer up. That's all I'm saying. I have an attorney. I'll bet you do. I'll bet you hired one the second you found out about the money because you knew what kind of hole you'd dug for yourself. My dad was a drunk, which you seem to know all about. So maybe you talked him into cutting us off so you could step into the breach. Let's not talk about this, okay? You want to hire an attorney? You can go right ahead. I told you to do that the first time we spoke. You have a copy of the will. You have the hearing date. And you can do anything you like. He turned without another word and moved around the back of his car to the driver's seat. He got in and slammed the door. It took him 2 tries to get his car started, but then he peeled out with a chirp. Anna was right. The guy was a drama queen. I unlocked the Mustang, tossed my duffel into the back seat, and my shoulder bag in the front. I got in, started the car, and pulled out of the slot. Such was the thrilling climax of my 24-hour sojourn in Bakersfield. By 10:52, I was driving west on California Street toward the southbound on-ramp to State Route 99. There were 2 more delays coming up, but I didn't know that yet, so I was excited about getting home. Bakersfield had been a bust. In the main, I'd accomplished my goals, but in doing so, I'd stirred up a nest of hornets. 2 of Dace's 3 kids were hopeless. I couldn't convince them their dad had been dealt a bad hand. As far as Ethan and Anna were concerned, his leaving me the money had only fanned the resentment they carried for years. How else could it have turned out? Of course they were angry. Of course they responded with more of the same. There were other elements in play. It would be disingenuous to claim I was above caring about $595,350. I'd never been close to that much money in my life, and while it wasn't really mine, it was certainly a subject worthy of consideration. Briefly, I fantasized about what would happen if I disregarded the terms of the will and divided the inheritance equally among the 3. How far might that go toward healing the rift? Nowhere. Ethan and Anna would blow their portion and then expect Ellen to fork over hers until that was gone as well. Ellen would agree because she felt guilty about the two of them, an attitude they'd fostered in her over the years. I toyed with the idea of handing over part of the money, say $100,000, divided three ways instead of the $500,000 plus. The flaw there was that if I thought they were entitled to a little bit of money, why not the whole amount? Either it was all right or all wrong. Acting in opposition to Dace's wishes was clearly wrong, regardless of Ethan's threats or Evelyn's maneuvering. Money aside, from their point of view, the crux of the problem was Dace's love affair with Hooch, and his refusal to give it up. In his children's eyes, he died preferring alcohol to them. Driving south on the 99, I hadn't even cleared the city limits when I caught sight of the highway sign for the Panama Lane off-ramp. The name jumped out at me, because I'd seen it in my paper search for Choker Lane, where the Milhones had lived in the early 40s. When I'd consulted the city map, the address was too far off the beaten path to worry about. At the time, Ethan Dace was uppermost on my mind. Now I was in range of the house where my father had lived, and the question was this. Did I care enough to delay my trip home? Nah, not so much. The Milhones were long gone, and getting back to Santa Teresa mattered more to me than exploring sites of historical family significance. I was curious, but going 5 miles out of my way seemed irksome when all I wanted was to put distance between me and Bakersfield. On the other hand, I was always thinking in terms of this other hand horseshit. Who knew if I'd ever be here again? Henry would ask what I'd learned, and I didn't fancy telling him I'd jettisoned the search. He wouldn't chide me, but I'd be chiding myself for not taking advantage of the occasion while I could. I signaled my intention, took the off-ramp, and pulled over to the side of the road at the first decent opportunity. I was annoyed. Why couldn't I go back to being an orphan like I'd been all my life? Had I ever once complained about it? No, I had not. I'd taken a certain peevish pride in being without close family. Now my lone wolf status had been taken away, and I resented the loss, even if it had always been entirely delusional on my part. As it turned out, I was embroiled in the same dysfunctional mess as everyone else I knew. I opened the oversized map, which was 36 inches by 50 and printed on slick, heavy-duty paper that was awkward to unfold. Once I wrestled it into submission, I ran my eye down the page and traced Panama Lane both east and west. The delicate lace of intersecting streets defined a succession of neighborhoods. This must have been farmland once upon a time. Perhaps much of it still was. The burgeoning city had spread out in all directions as the inhabitants multiplied. Through the windshield, I was looking at the same flat landscape that characterized the entire area, which was pockmarked with housing developments that finally gave way to open fields. Choker Lane was farther east, close to the north-south axis of Cottonwood Road. As I drove, I kept an eye on the passing street signs. Having committed myself, I could picture my spotting the old homestead. Perhaps I'd park and get out. I might knock on the door to ask the current occupant if I could make a quick tour of the rooms. It was possible the present owner had bought the house from someone who knew when it was built or how many hands it had passed through. I slowed in anticipation of my turn and took a left, checking house numbers as I proceeded from 4800 down to the 4600 block with a mounting sense of dismay. There was no 4602. The entire neighborhood was gone. I pulled over to the curb. Where the Milhone house had once stood, there was a settlement of condominiums. Identical six-story stucco structures arranged in a staunch grid spread over 25 or 30 acres. The few trees I saw were young and newly planted. The streets that branched off of Choker Lane had been named after New England states: Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island. If the colony continued to expand, the eastern seaboard might be called into play, starting with New Jersey and running all the way down to Florida. I pulled away from the curb and proceeded along Choker until I reached a set of ornamental gates. I turned in and cruised the roads that ran between the monolithic buildings. There wasn't much to see since they were all identical. My grandparents' house had been erased, as had the houses on either side, as had the homes extending for 6 or 8 city blocks in every direction. Even the soil had been excavated and carted away, so any relics, arrowheads, sun-bleached bones, the caps from old soda bottles, were gone now as well. I could take a metal detector and scan the surrounding area for 2 square miles without turning up so much as an old spoon. "This is your reward for denial," I thought. "You decide you don't care, and the family home vanishes." The irony wasn't lost on me. The universe was having a little tee-hee at my expense. Whereas the Kinsey branch of the family was chock-a-block with cousins, aunts, and uncles, even an ancient living grandmother, the Milhones had disappeared. As further punishment, I was now saddled with a cluster of second or third cousins related to me tangentially through Rebecca Dace, and I was far better acquainted with that bunch than I wanted to be. I'd also inherited the family corpse, a dead guy whose last rites had fallen to me. The only upside I could see was that the Daces made my mother's side of the family look like bastions of mental health. I headed back to the 99 and took up my southbound journey. 40 miles outside of Bakersfield, I checked my watch. It was 11:45, and I was starving. I hadn't bothered to eat anything before I left the hotel. I'd been more interested in getting the journey underway than in feeding my face. How foolhardy was that? I'd never make it to Santa Teresa without something to eat. I wouldn't arrive until mid-afternoon, and by then I'd be gnawing my own arm. I pulled my shoulder bag closer and fumbled through the interior, but all I came up with was a sugar-free breath mint of no known nutritional value. At that very moment, I realized I'd forgotten to call Henry to advise him of my estimated arrival time. That did it. I started scanning for highway signs, looking for the closest rest stop. Of particular interest was the crossed knife and fork, the universal symbol for fatty foodstuffs. Coming up on the Tejon Pass, I took the Fraser Mountain Road, where the Flying J promised numerous forms of relief, weighing scales, a pump dump, liquid propane, diesel fuel, a travel store, and overnight RV accommodations. The parking area was expansive, probably 300 spaces, only a small number of which were taken. Most important of all was the Denny's restaurant rising up in splendor. I parked 2 aisles away from the entrance, locked the Mustang, and went in. I availed myself of the facilities and then found an empty booth. A kindly waitress brought me water, a menu, and silverware. Since I'd eaten breakfast a scant 3 hours before, I skipped that section of the menu and looked at the garish photographs of burgers. Most were alarmingly large, double meat patties with cheese and all manner of falderal piled up in a bun. Feeling virtuous, I opted for a salad, knowing that before I left I could hoof it over to the mini-mart and stock up on candy bars. When I paid my check, I asked the cashier to make change for a $5 bill. I'd seen a pay phone outside the service station, and I was headed in that direction, when a middle-aged man approached from the parking lot and tagged me by the arm. "Is that your Mustang?" I turned to him with surprise. "It is." "I thought so. I saw you pull in. My wife and I had a booth by the window, and she's the one who called it to my attention. We were just having a closer look." "I take it you're a fan." "Yes'm, but that's not why I came looking for you. Are you aware you have a flat tire?"
"You're kidding. Flat, as in dead flat or low on air?" Come on, and I'll show you. I worried you might not notice it. You get back on the road, and the first thing you know, you'd be riding on the rim.
He turned and headed toward the rows of parked cars, and I quick-stepped to catch up.
Where are you coming from? He asked.
Bakersfield. I'm on my way to Santa Teresa. We passed through to the second aisle. His wife was standing by the Mustang, and she sent me an apologetic smile as though she felt responsible for the problem I'd been dealt. He said,
I'm Ron Swingler, by the way, and this is my wife, Gilda.
Kinsey Milhone, I said as we shook hands all around. I appreciate your taking the time to let me know about this. They shared a similar body type, round through the middle with truncated extremities. Easy to see how their shared lifestyle and eating habits had created the symmetry. What about you? Where are you from? I asked.
Texas. This is our honeymoon. We've been married 2 days.
There went that keenly observed conclusion. Then I caught sight of my left rear tire.
Well, dang, that is flat. Look here.
He pointed to a round metal circle the size of a pencil eraser between the sidewall and the hubcap, with its tiny silver horse in the center.
Looks like a roofing nail, which is technically called a clout nail. Short shank with that wide flat head. I put myself through college working as a roofer. This is the type we use to fasten shingles or roofing felt. Nail like that isn't but about that long, he said, showing me with his thumb and index finger. Pull it out, you'll probably see a ring or screw shank.
Weird spot for a nail. How you think it got there?
My opinion, you're looking at an act of vandalism. Somebody had to hammer this little fellow through your sidewall. You must have been parked in a bad neighborhood.
I guess I was, I said. I thought about Ethan appearing between the two cars, his tossing something ever so casually into the front seat of his Toyota. Ron Swingler said,
You want, I can swap that out for you, as long as your spare's in good shape.
Thanks, but I can talk to someone at the service station. I don't want to hold you up. Gilda spoke up, saying,
He doesn't mind. Why don't you let him give you a hand? It won't take 15 minutes, probably less, he said.
I thought about it briefly. These were good people, and I suspected the more I protested, the more they'd insist. Maybe their kindness would offset Ethan's malevolence to some extent. Actually, I could use the help if you're sure you don't mind.
My pleasure, he said. Why don't you and Gilda wait in the RV, and I'll come get you when I'm done?
Which is what we did. Their motorhome was parked one aisle behind the one I was in. Gilda unlocked the door to the RV and stepped in ahead of me, then turned back and held open the door.
You want coffee?
I'm fine. I'm hoping to get home without making another stop. Coffee would go right through me, I said. The interior was snug, two bench seats with a table between, a tiny galley-style kitchen, and a bed that seemed to fill the front end. I wasn't sure what we were going to talk about, but that wasn't a problem because she had plenty on her mind. As we took our seats, she said,
Let me ask you something. Do you have kids or grandkids?
I shook my head. I'm afraid not.
Listen to this and tell me what you think.
Ron has a granddaughter, Ava, who's 7 years old. She's all into figure skating, which she practices 22 hours a week. Her mom and dad, this is Ron's son and daughter-in-law, are spending $9,000 a year on lessons and competitions. Does that sound right to you?
I guess the discipline might be good for her.
I don't know what to think. 7 years old, and that's all she does. Doesn't read, doesn't play with Barbie dolls. She hardly ever goes outside, for Pete's sake, and that's all I cared about when I was her age. There's something off about that.
I hear you, I said.
What's her mother thinking is what I want to know.
She went on in this vein long after my interest waned. I tuned her out, making polite mouth noises while I checked the wall clock behind her. I could tell she was processing the idea of keeping her mouth shut, which is generally a smart move, though I've never mastered it myself. When her husband finally opened the door and told me the spare was in place, I thanked both of them profusely. I didn't want to bolt when he'd just done me such a service, so we chatted for a bit. I expressed my gratitude again, and he waved aside my thanks. I knew better than to offer him money. He was clearly a man who enjoyed being of service to women in distress. We finally effected our farewells, and I continued on to the payphone, where I piled change on the metal shelf, inserting coins and dialed Henry's number. He picked up on the third ring. "This is Henry." "Hey, Henry, it's Kinsey. Sorry I didn't have a chance to call you earlier." "Where the heck are you? I thought you were on your way home." "I am, but I had a flat." I filled him in on my stop for lunch, wondering how far I might have gotten driving on a tire with a nail driven into it. No point in worrying about it now, so I moved on. "How's Felix doing?"
"Not well. He developed a clot on his brain, so they had to go in and operate. Now it looks like he's fighting some sort of secondary infection, which is more bad news."
"Is he going to make it?"
"Hard to know. William swears he's on his way out."
"William thinks everybody's half dead. What do the doctors say?"
"They don't seem optimistic. It's not what they say, it's the look in their eyes," he said. "I'll be glad to have you home. What time do you think you'll get in?"
I checked my watch again. It was now 1:22. "Not for another couple of hours."
"Why don't you plan on having supper here? You'll be tired, and you'll need a glass of Chardonnay."
"Sounds good." We were winding up the conversation, and I was close to hanging up when he said,
"Oh, I almost forgot. Your friend Dietz is on his way down from Carson City. He says he should be here by 6, so I invited him for dinner, too."
I could feel myself squint.
"Dietz?
What's he want?"
"I guess there's a problem with that job referral."
"Job referral?"
"That's what he said. I figured you know what he was talking about."
"I have no idea."
"You can ask him yourself when he gets here," he said.
And with that, he hung up. Chapter 23. Naturally, the rest of the trip was uneventful, and the miles flew out behind me at warp speed. Just when I longed for a delay, a minor car wreck perhaps, or a sudden bout of the runs that would have me getting off the highway at every other exit, lest I mess my underpants, there was no such luck in store. Feeling crabby and out of sorts, I brooded about Ethan Dace hammering a nail into my tire. And then, as if I wasn't sufficiently annoyed, I took a little trip down memory lane, summing up my relationship with the aforementioned Robert Dietz. I'd met him 5 years before, in May of 1983, when I found myself on the hit list of a small-time Nevada punk named Tyrone Patty, who'd been charged with attempted murder in the shooting of a liquor store clerk. He'd fled to Santa Teresa, and I was assigned the task of tracking him down, which I did. He was sent back to Nevada, where he was tried, convicted, and thrown into prison. From that point on, his life had spiraled out of control, and he held four of us personally accountable. Me, the Carson City DA, the judge who'd sentenced him, and Lee Galishoff, the public defender who'd represented him. Never mind that Tyrone Patty was a persistent felon long before we entered the picture. Like many whose poor choices have led them astray, he accepted no responsibility as long as he had someone else to blame. Once out of prison, he'd gone right out and murdered 3 more hapless victims, also our fault, no doubt. But while still in prison, he'd put out feelers for a contract killer to whack the 4 of us. Galishoff had gotten wind of it and called, urging me to hire a bodyguard, which I thought was absurd. Who can afford a bodyguard 24 hours a day? Was he nuts? He'd suggested Robert Dietz, a PI who specialized in personal protection. I'd recognized the name because I'd put a call through to him the year before when I needed a quick job done, and it made no sense for me to travel all the way to Carson City. Galashoff gave me his number again, and I jotted it down with no real intention of contacting him. I just picked up a new job, and I was on my way to the Mojave Desert. I didn't take the threat seriously until someone ran my VW off the road and into a ditch. I ended up in the hospital, and that's when I called Dietz. He agreed to escort me back to Santa Teresa. In that same phone call, he told me the judge had been gunned down in front of his own home, despite the presence of the police. Dietz showed up in my hospital room and drove me home in his little red Porsche. Once the jeopardy passed and life returned to normal, if Dietz and I ended up in the sack, that was really nobody's business. What followed was a 3-month live-in relationship, at which point Dietz took off for Germany, where he was under contract to the military to conduct anti-terrorist training. I was miffed by his departure, but what choice did I have? He'd said, "I can't stay." I'd said, "I know. I want you to go. I just don't want you to leave me." We connected again in January of 1986, after an absence of 2 years, 4 months, and 10 days. That visit bled over into March, a period during which he had knee replacement surgery, and I agreed to drive him back to Nevada. By the time we parted company, I'd spent 2 weeks at his place in Carson City playing nursemaid, a role in which I have never been known to shine. I'd driven a rental car from there to Nota Lake, picking up an investigation that would have been his to handle if he hadn't been laid low. I hadn't seen him since. I'm not an on-again, off-again kind of girl, and Dietz wasn't good at staying put. So emotionally, we were always at odds. To be fair about it, neither one of us was suited for a long-term commitment. Dietz was afflicted with wanderlust, and I was chronically self-protective, having been married and divorced twice. Here's how it seems to work in my life. Usually when you say goodbye to a friend, it's a casual matter because it doesn't occur to you that you might not see that certain someone again. It's an a bientôt kind of thing, a term I remember from my high school French class. These are the few phrases I committed to memory, even though I never got better than a C on a test. A bientôt, see you soon. À plus tard, see you later. À demain, see you tomorrow. À tout à l'heure, see you in a while. When it comes to partings, the French are ever the optimists. My outlook is bleak. While my attention is fixed on the totally wrenching boo-hoo of an impending separation, the French language conveys hope and expectation. The happy assumption that in a short period of time, they'll be bonjouring each other all over again. My lifelong goodbye experiences lean toward finality and pain. My parents died. My aunt died. My first husband died. I'm dead set, as it were, against having a pet because the risk of loss would soar into the stratosphere, and I've got troubles enough as it is. After our last parting, I'd set Dietz out on the curb, metaphorically speaking, in hopes the alley fairies would come along and cart him away. It's not that I never thought of him, but by and large, people in my life knew better than to mention his name. Now, here he was again, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. I pulled up in front of my studio apartment at 425. I grabbed my shoulder bag and duffel, locked my car, and made my way through the squeaky gate and around to my front door. I left my Smith Corona in the trunk of my car, intending to take it into the office with me first thing Monday morning. There was no sign of Henry, but the backyard smelled of pot roast and freshly baked bread, both of which he does to perfection. I let myself in and carried my duffel up the spiral stairs to the loft. I'd been telling myself Dietz's arrival didn't matter one way or the other, but I postponed my official appearance at Henry's door until I'd slipped into a change of clothes. I stuck to my standard outfit, black turtleneck, blue jeans, and boots. I didn't want it to look like I was trying too hard. I skipped the makeup, which I seldom wore in any event. I did floss and brush my teeth and then stared at myself in the bathroom mirror. In novels, the protagonist is forever doing this because it affords the author an opportunity to describe the character's physical traits. That ploy won't work here because I always look exactly like myself. This can be discouraging. Sometimes when I'm standing in a supermarket checkout line, I'll spot the cover of a tabloid magazine plastered with candid photos of well-known actresses the paparazzi have caught off guard. What a shock it is to see legendary beauties looking washed out and furtive, with matted hair, puffy lids, and splotchy complexions. Flaws made all the more alarming for the images we carry of them, creamy-skinned and doe-eyed, with tresses artfully tousled and sprayed to a hard shine. My looks fall somewhere between the two extremes, but closer to the puffy end. To my credit, I don't misrepresent my basic attributes with a lot of gunk. Anyone who's startled to see me looking splotchy hasn't been paying attention. It was 4:55 when I knocked on Henry's back door. I was feeling more curious about Dietz than uneasy, which shows you what a moron I am. Dietz wasn't due for an hour, and I was grateful for a brief interlude alone with Henry, so I could fill him in on my trip to Bakersfield. Henry let me in. He'd already opened a bottle of Chardonnay, resting now in a cooler on the kitchen counter. I grant you it was a teeny tiny bit early for a glass of wine, but how could I refuse the half a glass when he handed it to me? He poured himself a tot of blackjack over ice, and we sat down at the kitchen table. One of Henry's many endearing qualities is his interest in matters that are of interest to me. He has remarkable recall of my past attitudes and behaviors, and he doesn't hesitate to bring inconsistencies to my attention. He's also free with his opinions, even if they don't coincide with mine, which is an irritating trait, but one that I've come to appreciate. He had two freshly baked loaves of bread sitting on a towel on his kitchen counter, and his oven was exuding enough mild heat and roasting aromas to make the room feel cozy. I knew he'd serve a salad and something simple for dessert. Of particular interest on this occasion was the presence of the cat, who had apparently taken possession of Henry and everything related to him. Ed had been in residence only briefly when I'd taken off for Bakersfield. I could still hardly believe I'd been there so short a time when it felt like I'd been gone for so long. I said, "Tell me about Felix. How's he doing?" Henry waggled his outstretched hand in a gesture that indicated not so good. "After supper, we can go over to St. Terry's if you like. He's unconscious, so you can't actually visit, but you could look in on him. The nurses are kind, but I don't like being underfoot. As one nurse put it, ICU doesn't lend itself to looky-loos." "No improvement at all?" "They've been pumping him with antibiotics, which I gather hasn't done much good. In a situation like this, things tend to go from bad to worse. I don't mean to sound so pessimistic, but there's no point in mincing words." "How's Pearl holding up?" "She's currently off on a bender, from what I hear. Your friend Dandy as well." "You can't be serious." "Oh, yes. I was at the hospital last night, and Pearl was conspicuously absent. She'd been at his bedside as faithful as a hound whenever she was allowed. Suddenly, no sign of her. So I stopped by the shelter as soon as I left the hospital. I couldn't get a word out of Ken, the guy at the desk. But one of the residents heard me ask about her, and he took me aside, which is when others chimed in."
"Are they holed up someplace?"
"Someone suggested a sports bar in the area. I don't know the name."
"Dandy mentioned the place. They played darts there on weekends if they're sober enough."
"I doubt they're playing darts. I'd have looked for them myself, but I don't have the patience."
Throughout this exchange, Ed was sitting in Henry's rocking chair, following the conversation solemnly with his oval eyes, the one blue, the other green. He was short-haired and white, with a patch of black over the right side of his face and touches of black and caramel on the left.
His ears stood straight up, triangles lined with pink and edged in black. His stub of a tail looked like a black and tan powder puff. Henry regarded him with a doting expression, which the cat seemed to think was entirely his due. I nodded at the cat. How's he been? Looks like he's settled in and made himself at home. He's a very good boy. He's caught everything from mice to moles, two lizards yesterday and one today. I hope no birds or bunnies. Of course not. We had a chat about that, and I explained his limitations. He comes when he's called, and he doesn't play in the street. I thought Japanese bobtails were supposed to be talkative. He hasn't uttered a peep. He only speaks up when he has something to say. Is it okay if we discuss him like this when he's sitting right there? He likes being the center of attention. He's even taught me a trick. Watch this. Henry picked up a wad of yarn the size of a golf ball. Ed was instantly interested, and when Henry tossed it across the kitchen, Ed streaked after it, brought it back, and dropped it at Henry's feet. Both Henry and Ed seemed extremely pleased with themselves. Ed watched Henry for a bit to see if they'd play again. I said, "This is weird. Like you just had a baby and all we're going to do from here on out is sit and stare at the little tyke and admire everything he does." "Don't be churlish," he said. "Tell me about your trip." This I did while I set the table and Henry put together a rustic apple tart, rolling out a round of pie dough that he covered with pared apple slices, butter, sugar, and cinnamon. He seemed to recognize that I was still trying to settle on an attitude about my newly discovered cousins, so we didn't pursue the subject beyond the basic information. Meanwhile, Ed curled up in the rocker and closed his eyes, though his ears continued to twitch like rotating antennae. "So, what's with Dietz? I can't believe he called after all this time. He put in a fair amount of effort looking for you. He said he tried you at your office and tried you at home. He left messages both places, but when he didn't hear back, he called me, asking if I knew where you were. I said Bakersfield, but you'd be back this afternoon. He said he was on his way, and then he hung up." "No explanation?" "He doesn't strike me as a man who explains himself." "Good point." Henry opened the refrigerator door and took a bag of fresh salad mix from the crisper drawer. "I wonder if you'd give these a rinse. The package says ready to eat, but that's a relative term. Lettuce spinners in there." He indicated the corner cabinet that was outfitted with a Lazy Susan so that cooking items could be stored in otherwise dead space. I opened the cabinet and removed the spinner, took out the perforated inner bowl, dumped the loose lettuces in, and ran water over the greens. I popped the bowl back into the spinner and pulled the cord, which made the inner bowl rotate at high speed, excess water flung off by the centrifugal force. The rapidly retracting cord snapped back and caught me in the hand. Wow, shit, hurt, ow! I was happy for the distraction. Henry had mentioned an estimated 6 o'clock arrival time for Dietz, whom I knew to be punctual. I stole a quick glance at my watch. It was only 5:20. So I figured I was still in the safety zone. I couldn't imagine why a job referral would warrant a trip to Santa Teresa. Maybe he meant to refer me for a job. I knew I hadn't sent any business his way. When the knock came at Henry's aluminum screen door, the sound barely registered. So I was startled when Henry opened the door and I heard Dietz's voice. In the first glimpse I had of him, I knew something major had gone down in his life. As usual, his hair was shorn close, but the medium gray had now turned almost entirely white. Something in the change suggested he'd been hit with an emotional blast, like a flash fire that leaves singed hair where your eyebrows had once been. I blinked and saw him restored to himself, looking as he always had. The white was the natural progression of a graying process already underway. His nose was long and sharp, humped at the bridge where a fan of lines ran upward, intersecting the horizontal lines that traced his forehead. It was the gray eyes and the deep tan that made his face arresting, along with the occasional lopsided smile. He wasn't a big man, maybe 5'10". He was light-framed, narrow through the shoulders, with a wiry strength as opposed to brawn. In the past, he'd worked out with weights and he'd run 6 miles a day, except for the stretch when his bad knee proved too painful. He'd apparently recovered from the knee surgery with no lingering effects. At least he had no limp that I could see. He looked tired, but then maybe we all look tired as the years mount up. He wore the same boots, faded blue jeans, and the same tweed jacket I'd first seen him in, complete with a black turtleneck. I put a self-conscious hand to my own black turtleneck, wondering if anyone would notice the match. He'd taken me in with a glance. I was the same as I'd always been, but I wondered if he saw a difference. I caught Henry's gaze flicking from me to Dietz and back. He seemed to hold himself in suspension, removing his personhood while Dietz and I sorted ourselves out. I said, "How was the trip?" "Good. Fast. Can't believe I didn't get a ticket." His tone was pleasant, but he didn't meet my eyes. What was that about? "You still have the Porsche? I expected to hear your car rumbling from half a block away." "Still here. I thought about a new one, but mine's only 10 years old. Henry said, "How about a drink? Blackjack on the rocks?" Dietz smiled. "Good memory." "Have a seat," Henry said. "Just let me freshen up." "Sure thing. Bathroom's that way." Dietz left. Henry and I exchanged a look, wondering what had prompted the 9-hour drive. There wasn't time to discuss the matter, so we went about our business, leaving it up to Dietz to explain himself. His usual style was to jump right in. By the time he emerged from the bathroom, a scant 4 minutes had passed. Henry had dropped ice cubes into a highball glass and poured whiskey neat. "Water?" "Perfect as is, thanks." Dietz sat down. As though coaxed, Ed jumped down from the rocker and jumped up into Dietz's lap. He did this without appearing to crouch and spring. He seemed to levitate. 4 paws on the floor, airborne, straight up, 4 paws in Dietz's lap, as neat as you please. Ed steadied Dietz at close range, the two eye to eye. Dietz ran an idle hand along the cat's head, and the cat arched against his palm. Dietz scratched behind one ear. Daintily, Ed curled up in his lap, prepared to nap with his head on his paws. Henry took note of Ed's vote of approval. I had to suppress the urge to roll my eyes. A conspiracy of men, and Ed was leading the charge. What had I ever done to him? We chatted while we ate, skipping from topic to topic, avoiding anything significant. The longer this went on, the more tense I felt. I didn't know if Dietz was delaying so he could talk to me alone, or if he was setting the stage for a showdown. I thought it was better to have Henry on hand while I heard him out. I felt guilty, but I didn't know what I'd done. Dessert out of the way, Henry inquired whether either of us wanted coffee. I declined, and Dietz shook his head in the negative as well. I looked at Dietz. "So, what's up?" The smile he turned on me was set, and I could see now how angry he was. Not a hot anger, but the cold, flat kind that's all the more dangerous because it's been driven underground. "I was hoping you'd tell me,"